Hello, my friends. Good evening and welcome into another edition of JMAC Show Prep. This is the show where we read the stories together. I get your first blush response. Leave those in the comments. Again, this show is not live. It is pre-recorded, so put your comments there where they belong. Also, take a minute to please like, subscribe, and share this content so that I can continue to bring it to you. So I've flagged several stories tonight, kind of a broad range of different topics. From supply chain to COVID to the abortion law in Texas. So a lot of things here to talk about tonight. And I'm going to add a separator for those of you who are on the podcast who can't have any visual cues as to what we are talking about or what stories we are moving through. I'm going to add this little sound effect here. When you hear that sound, you know that I'm moving on to the next topic, okay? Let's see if I can remember to do that. That will be an interesting test as well. So again, here's the sound. Dramatic, right? That means prepare for more. All right, let's start off tonight with the Supreme Court and their hearing opening arguments when it comes to the controversial new Texas abortion law. And I was actually glad to hear some of their questions. And I heard a lot of that on the news, but haven't read this story. This is a CBS Dallas story that I'm going to be reading to you. Let's see. The U.S. Supreme Court justices fired off numerous questions Monday about how the state's controversial new abortion law is enforced. They did so during an oral argument involving two lawsuits against the state of Texas, one filed by abortion providers and the others by the U.S. Justice Department. The Texas Heartbeat Act, as it's named, has prevented most abortions from being performed in the state since it took effect on September 1st. So, congratulations, Texas. You passed a law that did its job. The question is whether or not the law is constitutional. The story goes on, unlike most laws which are enforced by government officials, the Texas law, also known as SB 8, is up to private citizens to enforce by filing civil lawsuits against abortion providers. If found liable, abortion providers could pay a $10,000 penalty per procedure. The issue is whether abortion providers must wait to file a constitutional challenge against the state law until after they violate it. The attorney representing abortion providers who sued the state told the justices the state's new law seeks to do an end around the constitutional rights upheld by the court. Under SB 8, doctors can perform abortions after cardiac activity is detected. That can be around 6 weeks when many women don't know they're pregnant. Mark Huron, attorney for abortion providers, told the justices, the combined effect is to transform the state's courts from a forum of protection of rights into a mechanism for nullifying them. Elizabeth Prelogar, the U.S. Solicitor General, argued, quote, Texas is responsible for the constitutional violation here. It enacted a law that clearly violates this court's precedents. It's designed to thwart the law by judicial review by offering bounties to the general public to carry out the state's enforcement function. The Texas Solicitor General argued because civil lawsuits are used to enforce the law, state and local officials can't be sued. Quote, federal courts don't issue injunctions against laws, but against officials enforcing laws. No Texas executive official enforces SB 8 either, end quote. I was honored to be in court today representing that viewpoint and representing the laws of the state of Texas that we believe in the people of our state have elected our representatives to do. Now, some of the things brought up by the justices. This is Justice Amy Coney Barrett. she was concerned that there were several provisions in SB 8 that really are quite lopsided to try to prevent the defendant from establishing some affirmative defenses. Another moment mention came when Justice Stephen Breyer quoted former Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes. Quote, "I think that what Justice Breyer was emphasizing is that when the Constitution of the United States provides certain rights and the United States Supreme Court interprets those rights, it's not up to the states to decide which rights are going to be enforced, which our rights are going to be avoided or prohibited or made difficult to pursue." And that's precisely what SB 8 is all about. Now, this is where, if I'm reading right, where the justices got to the heart of the matter. The justices also asked if the Texas law were upheld, could other states enact similar laws involving the constitutional rights of freedom of speech, religion, and the right to bear arms? Yay! I got a sound effects machine here. I might as well use it. And you're like, "Oh no, J-Mac, no, please." These are again some of the other questions that have come up, and this has been the heart of the issue for me. Basically, what the precedent that is being set here by the state of Texas is that if you don't like something that the Constitution or a Supreme Court ruling protects, then you can simply bypass it by making it a public issue, not a government issue. You can empower individuals to file lawsuits, and you can clear the way for them and provide bounties for them. This is why I've been against this law. I do not believe that whether you are pro-life or pro-choice should impact how you feel about this law. Because if this law is allowed to stand, then California or New York or some other liberal state can come out and issue a bounty on gun possession. And they can say, "Hey, we're not violating your rights. We're just allowing other people to sue you." Now, you might be saying, "But Jay, abortion isn't in the Constitution." And I've made this clear several times, but let me do it one more time. Abortion is in the Constitution because of Roe v. Wade. The Supreme Court is not just this, excuse me, the Constitution is not just what is written in those words. It is also any decision made by the Supreme Court becomes a de facto part of the Constitution. So it's as sacred and as enforceable as any other thing that is written or codified in the Constitution. So if you allow a Supreme Court decision to be overturned by making a, guns illegal by virtue of the public being able to file lawsuits, making it a civil issue instead of a punitive issue, then you open up the door to speech, you open up the door to religion, you open up the door to all of the other things listed in the Constitution and every other Supreme Court ruling can now be messed with or enforced. That's why I am convinced that the Supreme Court is not going to let this stand. If they do, this will be such a dangerous precedent, and conservatives, in their zeal to get any legislation for pro-life through, will actually be opening the gates, the floodgates, to other assaults on their cherished freedoms. So this is one of those things where I'd like to use the partisan reversal test to see if this were reversed, if they would support it. And I don't think they would. Now, I have a cool graphic. You won't be able to see this in the podcast, But I've got a fun, cool new graphic here for the partisan reversal test. And
the partisan reversal test.
Yes. So if we flip this and we say the Democrats were doing this for guns, would you support it? And the answer must be no. It must be no. And if you're saying, well, guns are in the Constitution, but abortion is not, I'm sorry, that's not the way it works. Any Supreme Court decision becomes part of the Constitution until it is overturned. And you cannot allow states to simply bypass that by making it a civil issue. This is dangerous, my friends. Dangerous. We need to stop it. All right, let's move on to the next story. That's what that sound means. This is about the supply chain. Again, another CBS Dallas story. The supply chain is the series of steps that brings a product to a customer. But right now, store shelves are partly empty. Deliveries are delayed and prices are rising. Bottlenecks at many steps along the way are keeping products out of the hands of consumers, and the economy is paying the price. I've been watching this. I know you've been watching this. I've tried to order stuff. It takes forever. I was in IKEA. The place is empty. They have nothing. And of course, everybody wants to jump on the bandwagon and blame Biden. And if we did the partisan reversal test again, and if Trump were in office, they wouldn't be blaming Trump. They might be blaming the real actual source. In fact, we were having a conversation the other night around the dinner table. And yeah, sometimes people do that still, by the way. And the question was asked, how, it's not like we were using more toilet paper during the pandemic. How come we're running out of toilet paper? And I had to explain that we live in a just-in-time supply chain society, that local stores do not stockpile. They don't carry these huge inventories. It helps them with their cash flow. They don't tie up a bunch of their dollars in inventories. We have a shipping system that allows for inventory to be ordered automatically based upon computer scans and arrive just in time to be put on the shelves. So it's not like suddenly we didn't have toilet paper produced back at the factory. It's that the supply chain can't just suddenly take a jump in demand on a particular product. We don't have the truckers, we don't have the services to suddenly say, boom, we need to increase all of this stuff. So this just in time is fine during regular times, non-pandemic times. But I think that these supply chain issues are making everybody realize that we've got to have some backup plans. We've got to figure out a way to, I don't know if it's stockpile stuff, I don't know what the answer is, but there has to be a balance between just in time and stocking up at least essentials. Because when essentials can disappear in a day and you're not going to see them again for weeks or more, that's a real problem. Okay, back to the story. The supply chain for any given company can start with suppliers of raw materials and other inputs. Once a product is made, it travels along the network from the factory to a warehouse to a store and ultimately to the final customer. Various agents, brokers, vendors, transportation companies, and distribution centers can play key roles along the way in ensuring a product gets made and reaches its final destination. Thanks to a variety of problems exacerbated by the global COVID pandemic, the supply chain is not acting as it should. Cargo ships carrying approximately 500,000 shipping containers filled with goods from various countries in Asia await offloading at the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach. Once they are offloaded, a shortage of truck drivers prevents those containers from moving out of ports in a timely manner. Railroad terminals, where trucks deliver goods for the next leg of the journey, are backed up with containers awaiting further transport, which in turn also block inbound trains. And I will also add that there's only so many of these containers, shipping containers, that you see on trains. And, you know, those big old ships that are stacked, it seems like a mile high, with those shipping containers. Well, those are all filled and sitting at the ports waiting to be emptied. What normally happens is those ships return and you have these supply, these containers being filled, sent over, sent back, filled, sent over. When they're all sitting there waiting to be emptied, there are no containers on the other side to be filled. So it's this huge backlash, this huge problem that is being created. The story goes on, should those goods somehow make it to a warehouse, worker shortages are limiting their timely processing. And those are just a few of the issues. A global microchip shortage exacerbated by Texas winter storms that affected domestic production is slowing the production of cars and various electronic devices. China, where many consumer goods destined for America are produced, is suffering through an ongoing energy crisis that's curtailing manufacturing. And manufacturers in many other countries with lower rates of vaccination have endured shutdowns and worker shortages brought on by the spread of the Delta variant. All this happened just as a shift in spending brought on by COVID has drastically increased demand for products. The situation is fluid and will likely remain that way through the holiday season and into the new year. This is not a situation that any president would have been able to solve. I don't care if it's Trump. I don't care if it's Biden. This has been 2 years in the making. And unfortunately, it's just going to have to try and solve itself. That's not to say that there aren't things that the current president can do. We know that Biden has been working with the ports to get them to be open 24 hours. In order to do that, they have to have labor. They have to have people to take those jobs. And that's really just one part of the whole supply chain bottleneck. And as consumers, man, we're getting ready for Christmas. We feel like we might be coming out of COVID. And so we want to spend more. But guess what? The stuff isn't on the shelves right now. So that makes it very, very difficult. I think it's unfortunate that President Biden is going to pay a price for this, because the right is going to use it against him. The left would be using it against Trump. This is what we do in politics. But none of it is reality. The reality is this is what happens when you have a global pandemic. And guess what? Every country is experiencing the supply chain issues. This is not, and that's a good way to find out. Is it caused by our current president, or is it something that is happening to many other countries? If it's happening to many other countries, hard to blame our guy for it. And if you do blame him, I won't rule that out. If you want to blame Biden, let me know, what he did to cause it. And that's only part of the equation. And B, what should he have done to solve it? Because if you're gonna present that blame, I'm assuming you're saying Trump would have done differently, which I'm willing to accept, because he's a businessman and he probably has a better understanding of these things. But what would he have done differently? Excuse me, to preempt all this. I would love to hear your feedback on that. Okay, let's move on to the very next story. The other night when we were doing our live broadcast on Thursday night, we learned that a state representative was stepping down, Steve Christiansen. And this story stood out to me because he's one of the main voices that was calling for the audit, the Utah audit. And I had gone after him because he's openly admitted that he doesn't have evidence of fraud, but he needs to do an audit so he can find the fraud that he believes happened. And again, why do you believe there was fraud? The state went for Trump, and in all of the statewide offices, those all went for Republicans. So what is your evidence of voter fraud? And I've been wanting to know and trying to get him on the show. Well, all of a sudden, on last Thursday night, he stepped down. Not only did he step down from the legislature, citing death threats to his family or threats of violence, he also left his job with the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And he didn't really say why. He just said so that they can move on. And something tells me there's much more to the story here and that there was probably pressure. Otherwise, I can see him leaving the legislature, but not his job at the church. I'm sure his job at the church is not leading towards threats to his family. Am I wrong about that? So anyway, this is an update. This is in the Salt Lake Tribune. A former Utah state lawmaker attempted to obtain the personal information and voting history of every single registered voter in the state before he resigned last week. And he tried to leverage his position as an elected official to obtain the data. Again, this is Representative Steve Christiansen, Republican, West Jordan. He's been at the forefront of pushing for a forensic audit. He asked for a legislative audit of the results in Salt Lake County in December, but that request has yet to be approved. In June, he traveled to Arizona to witness the audit firsthand. Both Christiansen and Representative Phil Lyman of Blanding were present at the August Cyber Symposium in South Dakota, put on by MyPillow CEO Mike Lindell. He and Lyman spoke about election fraud at a conspiracy-fueled conference in Salt Lake City last week. Christiansen, who resigned abruptly from both the Utah legislature and his job with the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints on Thursday, wasn't just pushing those baseless claims about voter fraud, he was determined to do something about it. According to documents obtained by the Tribune through an open records request, Christiansen asked the Lieutenant Governor's office for a copy of the entire Utah voter registration database for the 2020 election. The request included personal information for each voter, such as name, address, the date they registered to vote, birth year, political party, and email. He also asked for the info for Utah voters who requested those records not be released publicly. In his request, he cited a provision in Utah law giving access to those private records to a government official or employee acting in their official capacity. His request was denied by Lieutenant Governor Deidre Henderson's office. They said Christiansen was not entitled to those records, especially since some of the private records that he requested could include a voter's driver's license, date of birth, and Social Security number. Quote, while you are an elected member of the state legislature, there is nothing in your request letter that demonstrates that you are acting in the capacity of a government official or on behalf of a government entity. That's according to the Lieutenant Governor's response. After that denial, Christiansen doubled down, insisting his status as a lawmaker entitled him to those records. He said, my request was delivered to you on my official letterhead of the Utah House of Representatives and referenced by my position in that body. He then said, bottom line, my request is legitimate and legally justified. In a statement to the Tribune, Henderson defended her office's decision to deny access. Let's see, in that statement, the Lieutenant Governor said, voters deserve to have confidence that their personal information will not be used in inappropriate or illegal ways. Recent efforts of unauthorized people to obtain voter information for nebulous purposes should be concerning to everyone. My office will always strive to uphold the law and safeguard voter information. We never want anything to come between a voter and the ballot box. Fortunately, his information was not given. I can only guess that he wanted to somehow conduct an audit of his own since the state legislature is not following his request. I'm guessing that's what he was going to use the information for, but I really don't know. All right, and let's see. I have one more story for you tonight, or actually this morning. Depends on when you are listening. I've interviewed or spoken with Becky Edwards. She's going to join us on the program. I'd love to speak with Allie Eisen. We're going to invite her onto the show as well. These are challengers to Mike Lee, and I do think, based upon some of his recent actions, that he deserves a good challenge. And maybe that will force him to kind of return to the people instead of this Trump nonsense and some of the other things going on. So you've got Republicans mounting a challenge. So do they have a chance? Do they have a hope? Well, this is the Deseret News, and this is the most recent polling that just came out. Becky Edwards, Hall's... So the first part of the story, it's just interviews with Becky and Allie Isom. The two candidates for U.S. Senate have logged thousands of miles up and down Utah, but they have a lot of ground to cover to catch incumbent GOP Senator Mike Lee. I haven't met Allie yet. Like I said, I had dinner with Becky. I really enjoyed my sit-down with her. I feel that we are aligned in a lot of ways. She wants to build on common ground and get rid of this toxic, warlike behavior that is being carried out by both sides. Hopefully I'll get a chance to talk with Allie as well and bring you parts of that interview. But here's where they stand. So if the Republican Party primary election were held today, 53% of voters would choose Senator Lee, 7% Edwards, and 2% Isom. Another 6% would go for some other Republican, while 32% don't know. So even if Edwards or Isom were able to get that 32%, they still would not be able. Let's say Becky Edwards was able to get the 32% of the unknown and Allie Isom's 2%. That's still not enough to overcome Mike Lee. Now, campaigns are long, and I don't want to rule this out, and Becky's been doing well with fundraising, and so anything can happen. But this demonstrates to you how difficult it is to overcome incumbency. And so we'll have to wait and see what happens. But those are some pretty striking numbers. Again, it's early in the polling, so we'll have to wait and see. Those, my friends, are the stories for Jay McFarland's show prep. We read them together. I'd love to see your comments about any of them. Leave them wherever you are watching, YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn. This show's going out to all of those locations right now. Please take a minute and become a member of the JMAC Members Club. $5 a month, minimum. Minimum, I make it sound like you're required. As little as $5 a month will go a long way to help support this podcast. And you get great prizes as part of your membership. You get access to my blogs, to my books, to my webinars, depending on what level you come in at. And also, please remember to subscribe to this channel if you have not. Like it and share it. If you can't become a member, I understand, but you can like, and you can share, and you can subscribe. So all of that will help me out. With that, my friends, thank you so much for joining us. Join me tonight for JMAC Live. It'll be at 9:30 p.m. Mountain Standard Time. This is when we talk about a lot of these stories that show up in show prep, but we do a deep dive on them, and we take your live comments as well. So join me tonight, 9:30 p.m., Mountain Standard Time on all of the social media channels. I look forward to seeing you and hearing from you then.